The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the final Science Weekly of 2019. I'm Nicola Davis and I'm joined in the studio this week by my colleagues Hannah Devlin and Ian Sample.
For this episode, the Guardian science team have all piled into a studio and we're going to be talking through what for us were some of the standout stories from our 2019 reporting. Hannah, you're going to kick us off with a story about the Event Horizon Telescope.
This was definitely one of the standout stories for me. It was a story from a team of astronomers around the world, and they had captured the first ever image of a black hole. Well, technically it was the silhouette of the black hole traced out by a sort of halo of dust and gas. And there's a number of reasons why this was so exciting. I mean, I think the first one is maybe that we've known about black holes for so long. They were first predicted by Einstein. And although since then we've definitely accumulated a lot of evidence that they're out there, there isn't any doubt that they exist, it had become easy to forget that we'd never actually seen one. We'd never really pictured what they looked like. So it was just a really big moment in astronomy to have that image for the first time. And I think another really inspiring thing was the level of collaboration that it required. The image was made by a network of 8 radio telescopes that spanned from Antarctica to Spain and Chile, and it required this intricate coordination between the different telescopes to be able to have an accuracy of a few centimetres of where each telescope was positioned. So that engineering and kind of coordination was just really impressive.
So what does the image actually show? I mean, if it's a silhouette of a black hole, what does that really mean?
Yeah, so, well, in case you haven't seen the image, I'm sure a lot of our listeners will have, but it's a sort of black shadow in the middle surrounded by an orangey glowing halo. And so the black bit in the middle where you can't see anything, that's where the black hole itself is. And then the halo is showing you what's called the accretion disk around the black hole, which is a sort of swirling disk of dust and gas that's going around at incredible speeds. And what you're picking up is the radiation coming from that accelerating matter that's kind of whizzing around the edge of the black hole. Because of course, once anything crosses the threshold of the black hole, once it goes over the event horizon, it can't escape. So you can never actually picture the inside of the black hole. That's kind of as far as we know, a theoretical impossibility to see what's inside.
It's amazing, isn't it, that there are these images that become iconic of space. You think of the image of Earth from space and how that has captured people's imaginations. Do you think that this is one of those images that is going to kind of join that canon of important images in the way we think about space and our position in it?
It's perhaps not quite as iconic as the first image of Earth from beyond Earth. But I think the simplicity of the image, the fact that it's the first time we've seen it, and the fact it's got this kind of sinister sort of Eye of Sauron kind of look about it, I think it kind of made it really stick in people's heads. And you did get a lot of people sort of sharing silly memes and things of the picture straight away as soon as it came out. But there was definitely they wanted to make this release of the image a big moment. And there was a lot of secrecy around the picture to the point where I think one of the people at the press conference announcing it, France Cordova, who's the director of the US National Science Foundation, she said it was the first time that she'd seen the picture, and she said that she had tears in her eyes when she saw it because it was sort of such a big moment for her, seeing this black hole for the first time. And she's an astronomer, so it was obviously something she'd, maybe imagined what it looked like before.
I wonder whether also because the size of it is astonishing as well. I mean, not the size of the picture, but the size of the actual black hole itself is enormous, isn't it?
Yeah, the black hole that they released the picture of is in a galaxy called M87. And the black hole itself has the mass of about 6 billion suns. So
astonishing.
I mean, it's incredibly massive. But since it's a black hole and very dense, it's not, from an astronomy point of view, it's quite small.
So was this first one one of the easier ones to go for? Are they going to go for others in the future, which are going to be trickier?
Yeah, so when they set out, they had two targets. One was this M87 black hole, which is 55 million light years away from Earth. And then they were also trying to take a picture of Sagittarius A star, which is the black hole at the centre of the Milky Way. And you might think that the one in the Milky Way, which is much closer, would be easier to take an image of. But actually, it's proved much more difficult. And one of the reasons is it's much, much smaller. It's only about 4 million suns worth of mass in there compared to 6 billion for the other one. And then the other thing is we're sitting on Earth in one of the spiral arms of the Milky Way, and the black hole's right at the middle. So to see it, you're having to look through this plane with all this dust and gas and stars. And in terms of what it does to the light, that's kind of scattering the light everywhere, scrambling up what you're trying to look at. So to get that image, they're having to build all these computer models of what's happening to the light. And it's just a much more dynamic picture that they're trying to take a picture of.
So Hannah, what's the next step then that they're planning to take?
So I spoke to one of the scientists working on Event Horizon last week, and he said that it's looking really positive, that they're hoping to get an image out of the Milky Way black hole next year. So that's probably one of the big stories we can expect to see next year, and be interesting to see whether it's a different shape. I think it is predicted to be a different shape, theoretically. Yeah, so watch this space.
Great. Nicola, what story were you going to talk about?
Well, one of the stories that really stood out for me was the story about researchers rebooting pig brains hours after the animals died. So these were pigs who had been decapitated in a slaughterhouse, and their brains were hooked up to a sort of artificial blood circulating system. And the researchers found that these brains, which were hooked up to this circulating system about 4 hours after the pigs had died, and they were kept on it for about 6 hours, that after that time, these brains were still showing some signs of cellular activity, which I think, I mean, obviously, from the imagination point of view, that just conjures up all sorts of images. And the researchers were very quick to say, look, these animals are not conscious. This is not Frankenpigs. That's not what's happening here. What's happening here is a possible technique to help us to study the brain, to study interventions in the brain. So we know the brain is such a hugely complex organ, and it's extremely difficult to study. And obviously, there are lots of ethics involved in studying brains of living animals.
Is that supposed to be more ethically sound or more ethically sort of acceptable than putting the drugs into living pigs?
I think it allows you to study particular reactions sort of in isolation, as it were. It also would mean that you could see how those interventions would affect the brain on a bigger scale. So not just what it does to those cells, but perhaps what it does to other systems within the brain as well. So when you're studying just cells in a petri dish, you're only looking at those cells. But if you can study the organ as a whole, you can have a much better idea of what something is going to do.
It does feel like one of those things where it's blurring the line a bit between life and death. I mean, do they call the brains, are they alive?
So when we're talking about cellular activity, we're not talking about neurons talking to each other, as happens in our brains whilst we're, you know, chatting here. That's not what they're seeing. What they're seeing are things like the blood vessels still responding to certain triggers and sort of consumption of oxygen by the cells. So we're talking sort of active on a cellular level, but not on a kind of whole organ talking to each other sort of level. They also included chemicals to make sure that there could be no consciousness arise. So not only do they think it extremely unlikely that that would happen, but they actually made sure that they sort of suppressed any possibility that that could happen.
Why did they do that?
Well, because as one of the researchers said at the time, there are no ethics committees set up for the eventuality of consciousness occurring. So they basically lowered the temperature of the brain and used anaesthesia to stop any kind of activity happening, because there isn't really a framework if that had cropped up. And they said that if they had seen anything like that, even in this case, they'd have stopped the experiments because we're just not ready for that at the moment. They also said it's unclear at the moment if there's any chance that you could get consciousness. As I said, the kind of activity they're seeing is not sort of thinking. The animal is still dead. I mean, this is not a pig that's ever going to oink again.
I know this is probably the kind of question that people doing this research dread, but, you know, what are the possibilities for this being used clinically at some point? You know, if someone's got some kind of devastating illness and but their brain's fine.
Well, so I asked some experts this because I sort of said, well, you know, it does sound a bit Futurama, doesn't it? Brains in jars. But basically they said, look, what this is a temporary preservation of some basic cell functions. It's not the preservation of thought and personality. So that is such a long way off that the idea of body transplants is just far, 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 far away, if it would ever be possible at all. But I think what is interesting is one of the areas that they're really interested in is testing approaches for dealing with stroke and other issues that affect the brain. So that's one of the areas where they're hoping to be able to make some progress with this kind of model. And I did actually, I emailed the team to ask what their update is since that work came out, which I think was sort of in the spring. And they said that they're currently looking on what limits there are on the resilience of the brain and the technology they've developed. So again, it's the complexity of the brain and the fact that it's so hard to study it, but quite where it's going to go from there, I think we'll have to watch this space.
Okay, that's it for the first half. We'll be back after the break to hear from Ian and discuss what we're most looking forward to covering in 2020.
Welcome back to Science Weekly and our roundup of some of our 2019 science reporting. Before the break, Hannah talked about an exciting new image of a black hole, and I talked about researchers who are working on decapitated pig brains. Ian, what's been your standout story?
Well, I think looking at, you know, the most exotic objects in the universe and looking at profound questions between life and death pale into insignificance compared to something that was really pressing that came out this year, which was a study into how do we actually defend our food against seagulls when we're down at the beach. And it was what was remarkable about the story was quite how immediately global it went. This was a story where a researcher, really brilliant researcher at Exeter, went out with a bag of chips to various UK seaside resorts and did a whole bunch of experiments to see how long it took seagulls to approach said bag of chips and what sort of, just whether staring them out basically might deter them. And the actual study was trying to look at whether seagulls pay attention to where humans are looking. And she found that, lo and behold, those that come to get your food do seem to pay attention to where you're looking. And if you stare them out, then they would sort of take fairly sort of meandering routes. They sort of walk left and right, and then they sort of,
they
sort of
tum-ty-tum-ty-tum
come in a little bit and then sort
it.
Of skirt around the edges of where you were looking. But she found, you know, to be fair, not many birds approached when she was sat there with this bag of chips in front of her. About 3/4 of them just didn't bother. But of those that did, if you stared at them, it delayed them about 20 seconds before they would actually take the chips. So this was obviously a breakthrough in a long-running issue between humans and hungry wild animals. So I thought it was quite an interesting story.
Well, I have to say, as somebody who grew up in Cornwall, I think this is extremely important because that's a real hazard, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's always one of those sort of nice sort of schadenfreude amusements when you're down at the coast, when you see someone else's food being taken and away goes a sausage roll or an ice cream and you just think it's a ho-ho-ho moment and you think, oh, that's brilliant. But, you know, there is something actionable in this because the finding is that they will pay attention to where you're looking. And so as a result of that, a lot of attacks come from behind. And so if you can eat your food with your back against a wall, or with, I mean, I don't think anyone in England actually has a parasol, but you might have an umbrella on the beach. Well, of course you would. But on a lot of people may just have a golfing brolly on the beach or something like that. Or a freebie from a
spade.
You know, yeah. But basically, if you have something behind you, one of those dodgy stripy windbreaks or something, you know, that may actually do the job because the seagull actually can't get through.
Or do you and your mates just need to sit in a circle?
Basically,
facing outwards.
Well, that'd be quite an odd thing to do, but you can. Because all sorts of strategies have been brought in by towns and particular cafes for dealing with aggressive seagulls. And like, you know, there's one cafe where they've given people access to water pistols, so you can just shoot them when they come down. And there's other places where they've had birds of prey hanging around for a while that chase the seagulls away.
But aren't seagulls on the decline?
They are. Well, seagulls are in Britain. Seagulls are on the IUCN red list of threatened species. So it may not feel like it, but I think a lot of that is because there are a lot of seagulls in sort of certain urban environments where we find them, because they've started coming into those urban environments for all the food, right? But if you look at where their traditional sort of places would be, the numbers are really falling off. So it doesn't look like they're in trouble to us, because we see them, you know, we're actually on the same territory, and that's why you get these conflicts. But, you know, we've had some people suggest there should be culls of herring gulls to get around this problem, which just seems a really sort of blunt human approach to this, which, you know, I don't think it needs to be that way. And Madeline Gumas, the woman who did this work, was saying, you know, we can do things better. If we just learn how to handle very hungry wild animals and treat them as such, there's probably a way you can get around this problem without, you know, us feeling the distress of having our sausage roll nicked, but also without the birds having to be killed.
I think I was on holiday when this story came out, and it was one of the few news stories that I read while I was away. How did the researcher respond to it going so viral? I mean, it was story of the summer.
So poor Madeline. I mean, it was the first research paper she had written, and it was pretty tough on her, I think. Pretty overwhelming, because all of the sudden, everybody wants to speak to her within a very tight time frame. And so, you know, she's brilliant in that she'll chat and she's really good at describing all this stuff, but everybody wants to speak to her themselves. And there's radio shows in South Africa calling her up, and, you know, people in America, and, you know, the story was covered in the States, the story went everywhere. And so she had like just this enormous demand. And she had an email actually from her supervisor saying, I'm sure she won't mind repeating this, saying, oh, look, it's your first paper, but I just wanted to let you know so you're not disappointed in the future. It's not always like this. And she was, thank goodness, like, I really don't want it to be, you know, as much as she was glad to have the opportunity to talk about the work, I think she actually was relieved to know that it wouldn't probably be like that in the future.
So onwards to 2020, what's everyone looking forward to coming up in the science news cycle next year? Hannah?
Well, there's a few big space launches that are going to be exciting, I think. There's a solar orbiter that's going up in, I think it's in February, that's going to join another probe that's going around the sun called the Parker Solar Probe that's up there already. And I think together they're going to tell us a lot more about the sun and its atmosphere and solar wind. And then there's a couple of other exciting missions. There's, I think, going to be another Chinese mission to the moon that's going to return some samples of moon rock. And then there's at least one Mars mission, I think, possibly two, from ESA and NASA. And the ESA one is ExoMars, which it's kind of a mission in various stages. And they've got some bits of the mission already up there orbiting around Mars, but this bit is going to be the rover that will go and drill down and take samples from beneath the Martian surface, which, you know, potentially could give us some insights into whether there was once some form of life on Mars. So that's potentially going to be a big story for next year.
Ian?
I mean, continuing on the space front, one thing that's going to be quite a landmark next year, unless it gets delayed, and let's face it, that happens sometimes, is that the US will regain its ability to send astronauts into space, but through private means. And so obviously the US has always sent astronauts into space, either on the shuttle or previous rockets. And in 2020, we're expecting to see SpaceX and Boeing both try to take astronauts up to the International Space Station, which will just mark that moment that it was a moment that Obama engineered, of just pushing over low Earth orbit servicing to the space station to private companies. So NASA then looks at deep space. And so that's when, you know, NASA will be able to focus on things like all the stuff that's going to happen on the moon, which is going to be, you know, the really sort of interesting place for the next sort of 10 years, really. And then onwards to Mars. But I think we can leave that for a while. I don't think anyone's going to Mars for a long time. One of the other things I'm looking forward to next year is a decision by the US FDA, the sort of drug approval wing, as to whether Biogen's Alzheimer's drug gets to go to market or not. And this drug that Biogen have applied for permission to to hand out is a really interesting one, because it targets amyloid plaques in the brain, which is one of those proteins that we know built up in the brain in Alzheimer's patients. But the story of it's been very strange, because earlier this year, the company came out and said they'd done something called a futility analysis, which showed that the drug was never going to work. And then a few months later, they revised their decision and said, actually, when we look at some more data, we think it does have an effect at high doses in a certain group of patients. And at the moment, I would say that the specialists in this subject are pretty split. Some say, brilliant, let's get this drug approved. Even if it's having a small effect, we should approve it and that will make a difference. Others are saying this data is nowhere near enough to approve the drug. They need to do another trial, which could go on for several years, to actually nail what's going on with the drug. And I think that's going to be a key decision. Obviously, if that does get approved, it will be the first drug that actually affects the progress of Alzheimer's disease, which would be remarkable. Although whether it has a big effect in many patients, I think is a real big question.
What about you, Nicola? What are you looking forward to?
What I really look forward to is that every day that I come into the office, it's something new and often quite unexpected that's on my desk. So in the last couple of weeks, I've had everything from dolphins being kind of right-handed or right-flippered, I suppose you could say, to dinosaurs having feather parasites, to yet another story telling us that sitting down is really very bad for you. So it's that range of health and science which I find really exciting, and the fact that I just don't know what's going to cross my desk tomorrow, but it's always something fascinating.
Okay, that's it for today's episode. Special thanks to all the contributors we've had on the show this year and to all the listeners that have been in touch. We'll put links to all the stories we've been talking about today on the Science Weekly podcast page at theguardian.com.
We're off for a Christmas break, but we'll be back in the new year with an episode on Friday, January the 10th.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.